I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Author Karen Russell grew up in South Florida, and the Everglades forms the backdrop for her first novel, Swamplandia, the story of the Big Tree family who live on an alligator wrestling theme park. Her latest book, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, is a collection of short stories which takes the reader to locations as far-flung as Italy and Antarctica. I'll talk with Karen Russell about how growing up in the immersive landscape of South Florida and taking road trips through the Sunshine State influenced her writing. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined by New York Times best-selling author and South Florida native Karen Russell. Welcome.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Well, Karen, your new book of short stories is called Vampires in the Lemon Grove, and many of the stories are about transformation, about monsters, or at least people who are uncomfortable in their own skin and don't want to accept who they are. Why are these themes important to you?
Oh, goodness. I think a lot of writers tend to be outsiders. I just think that's generally true, or have some sort of alienated perspective that they occupied, you know, earlier in life. I think often people who are drawn to books, to, you know, bookworm, bookish kids, it's sort of like a safer zone where they can kind of consider how deeply strange it is to be alive. So, and I just loved, as a younger reader, I loved monster stories. And I think the figure of the monster in movies, you know, in popular culture, it's such an interesting mirror to certain parts of our natures that we want to deny or we don't want to confront, that we've repressed, sort of. So I think there's a real kind of attraction, repulsion that's interesting. And, you know, from a narrative perspective, that attraction, repulsion is it's a nice kind of tension. It's a nice thing to try to deploy in a story.
When you say when you were a younger reader, I mean, how young are you talking? You're talking like sort of Morris Sendak territory or a bit later than that?
That book terrified me. What a terrifying book, isn't it?
Where the Wild Things Are?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you're really, truly pre-verbal kids. I mean, readers that are actually just reading pictures in sequence are drawn to monsters, right? And I think it's funny, kids really do have an antenna out for it. They're not, you know, they don't have perspective or vocabulary, but they're not naive. And I think you really, from the outset of consciousness, pretty much are alive to some darker impulses or the potential for violence or cruelty or injustice, all these things. So it is kind of a concrete way to you know, think through violence when you're a child, for sure. You know, I loved Where the Wild Things Are. I liked stuff kind of, I had a precocious taste for, you know, like Stephen King and Bradbury and all of those guys. Edgar Allan Poe. It's great because he's taught in schools, but it's actually, you know, at an age when you can't see an R-rated movie, if you read an Edgar Allan Poe tale. I remember even before I had a real sense of what the, you know, what the language meant or any kind of, you don't know any of those literary techniques when you're, yeah, I wasn't sophisticated enough to pick up on them. But the atmosphere and just the mechanics of dread. And I mean, you can't, even if you have only the mistiest sense that somebody's being bricked up behind a wall, that's still pretty terrifying.
Let's just talk about some of the stories in this. I mean, the second story in this collection, Reeling for the Empire, involves a young woman who's been essentially tricked into working in a silk factory. And without giving away some of the kind of supernatural elements of it, instead of burying that memory of, you know, giving up her freedom, she uses the grief and anger and sort of channels it into saving herself. These are interesting themes. And how do you, as a writer, tap into these themes and use them to fuel your writing?
In past work, I haven't been as interested in kind of research, historical research, and this Reeling for the Empire thing. I loved writing it because I actually had a sense of what the ending would be from the outset, which almost never happens. I hope it doesn't. I mean, there's a way where I think you could, it does sound kind of like Oprah, Lifetime original movie, right? But that is the emotional life of the story, is that this Japanese woman becomes a monster. She's sort of turned into factory machinery, into this silkworm hybrid, at a time when Japan is undergoing this really rapid and it's going through its own kind of monstrous metamorphosis. I mean, the entire island is undergoing a metamorphosis from this isolated feudal nation to really they're adopting Western style industrialism. And the ports have been closed for 200 years and suddenly they're blasted open. So I think I was just thinking about the microcosm of this woman's body as being the site of transformation. And I don't know. I don't think I ever sit down with a clear set of I'm going to try to express these themes with these tools, right? It's never that. I wish there was like a Julia Child's recipe book or something. But I think the pleasure of a story for me is also being surprised.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know. I sort of had an idea of the general arc here that it would be a metamorphosis tale, but I certainly didn't know the woman's backstory, and I didn't know the degree to which regret would be something that she was able to find a utility for to kind of save herself.
So there's this backdrop of a time of colossal change in Japan, and that's an interesting history in itself. I mean, where do you get the inspiration for a story, though, where a young woman morphs into a silkworm? I mean, that's pretty far out.
I don't know. I feel like I have some best guesses, right? Like, I love Cronenberg's films. There's a lot of sort of industrial horror stories, you know, mutant transformations in his work. Coming from South Florida, I think, was a bonus for me as a writer because there's a lot of deep strangeness in this state. But I truly, you know, it's funny. It's a funny thing to go around and try to reconstruct the origin of a story. I think it's a just combo of – I was reading, I remember, David Graeber's Debt, which is a book that in part takes on kind of female debt slavery. So I guess there was sort of a lot in the mix. And then but who knows, right? It's kind of a spooky thing.
You mentioned Cronenberg, and reading this book of stories, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, I'm really struck by the cinematic nature of some of the imagery. I mean, the very vivid stories and the imagery you bring across is that they conjure up some pretty startling pictures in your mind. Are you a big fan of film and horror films in particular?
Yeah, I love horror films. I really do. And thank you. I'm glad to hear that. I think I tend to be sort of a visual writer. There are others, you know, Old Marcel, He's Olfactory, you know, there are other writers I think rely on different senses, or some are more cerebral, abstract, but I'll get pictures first, often, pictures of landscapes or images or whatever. And my brother and I, my sister, I don't know what particular deficiency that's filling, but we loved horror movies, you know, they were just vitamins to us. And whenever I go visit my brother now as adults, we just saw one called Triangle that I recommend to everybody. Pure dread. A ghost ship shows up. These people are stranded at sea and a completely empty ship in the Bermuda Triangle. So I'm always jealous of the immediate suspense, you know, that just that gut drop of dread that you can feel in a horror movie. Some of my favorite fiction does that trick too.
Do you think it's harder though to create that sense of urgent dread that you get in a horror movie with a book?
I mean, I think horror movies get some significant assists from music, right? I wish there was a way to score your story so you could have some, you know, isn't that amazing? If you've got the right score, it doesn't matter what the camera is focused on. If you have the right kind of like violin screech, like a blade of grass is suddenly terrifying. So I do think that there's a way. Language can do it too, right? But it's more participatory, and I think maybe it requires a little a collaboration with the reader, certainly. And I think film, there's something about the visual immediacy of it where it just gets you in a primal place.
What were some of your favorite horror films when you were growing up?
Oh my gosh. Anything based on a Stephen King novel I really liked.
And is he a writer you liked reading as well, or you'd still like reading?
I love reading him. I think he's getting better and better. He had a story collection, actually, Full Dark No Stars, that I thought really exquisite. And I haven't done his time travel JFK novel yet, but I'm excited to. And I do think it's funny to think that this one human being was so kind of prolifically dark that he haunted millions of people. I mean, there's something to me, too, about the idea that he's a bestseller. I find his stuff incomparably strange, truly frightening, you know? And the idea that so many people hearken to that weird tune, there's something kind of, I don't know what the right word is, certainly not reassuring. But it makes me feel less lonely anyways, because it's sort of it's a signal that even everybody's sweet librarians wearing a Gap vest reading Stephen King, you know, there's some acknowledgement that there is this darker side to things or whatever.
When you write some of these stories, do you have a goal at some point of saying, I'm going to try and scare the reader as much as possible, or are you trying to scare yourself?
Well, I hope to. You know, with these stories in particular, often there's just to inject some humility or levity. And, I would try to have some comedy in there too, right? Because I think that they're kind of two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
If you just go for complete darkness and exclusive tragedy, there's this way that it's going to feel sentimental and false, you know? And I think the best jokes kind of grow out of this sense of the deep, funny strangeness of things, is how a professor of mine put it once, which I liked a lot. But I think it is good to scare yourself as you're writing. I think it always feels like maybe I'm on the right track if I myself feel exposed or uncomfortable. With the Reeling for the Empire story, some parts of that were quite unsettling and sort of grotesque and really visceral and unpleasant. I guess the word is unpleasant. And I thought that that wasn't a bad thing, to be feeling that as I was writing it.
And the story Proving Up, I guess the basic outline is that it's a young boy or a young man out on a quest for his family. And there are some really spooky elements. And, part of what makes this story so frightening, I think, is by the end of it, you're not quite sure what's happened. Do you think there needs to be an element of suspense going beyond the end of the story for a horror story to really grab you?
I do. I really do. I really think... And those tend to be my favorite endings in fiction and film, where there's a kind of terrifying, unsettled quality. I mean, a real kind of uncanny hesitation between different possibilities. That always feels like the truest ending to me, in a way, because what endings do you ever get in this life anyhow, right? I mean, you don't want to put a nail through the coffin so the reader can take a breath. I think you want the haunting to continue inside the body of the reader, if a story is going to work at all.
You know, particularly the first story, about the title story, in fact, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, it's treating these traditional tropes of horror. It's almost like a disease that, afflicts humans. And that's something I think that comes across in Vampires in the Lemon Grove.
Yeah, it's funny. That story was composed, I promise, well in advance of Stephanie Meyer. I mean, it's one of the older ones in the collection, so I feel some chagrin now. Everybody is just... we're all kind of up to our eyeballs in vampire lore at this moment. The idea that there's this sort of like a disease, if you want to call it that, that doesn't permit them to mature in linear time like the rest of us, that they're so just a slave to hunger. And I just think it's such an acute exaggeration of a problem probably everybody alive feels, right? To be a slave to craving in that case, to really... I mean, so many monster tales are that, right? Like wanting connection, but having some kind of impairment or monstrosity or, unslakable thirst or whatever that's going to prevent you from overcoming your own isolation.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty old story, right? It's a pretty universal one. Now, what is going? Why do you have a sense on why zombies are? This is like their moment. Why?
Well, at the end of last year, there was the talk of the Mayan apocalypse, but I wonder if there's some kind of sense of the talk of global climate change and things like that. I wonder if that's sort of permeating into popular culture a bit.
I do think that there's so much apocalyptic dark fantasies, even like reality TV now, right? I happen to catch that in the hotel. There's like this show about people stockpiling for the end times.
Mm-hmm.
Who can most effectively prepare for, post-nuclear disaster or whatever.
Doomsday preppers, I think.
Doomsday preppers. I couldn't believe that. I thought it would be completely tongue-in-cheek, but these people earnestly, they've got, militias and a lot of Gatorade. I mean, it's also sort of like the poverty of our imagination, too. It's like, what kind of apocalypse do we want to be so well hydrated for? But I do think it's interesting. There's some kind of deep glee, too, sometimes in imagining the order falling away. And these hierarchies collapsing. And I was thinking with these stories, I really wanted to take on the monster's perspective, at least half the time, because I think that line between monster and victim gets really blurry. And like the story you mentioned, Proving Up, I think the homesteaders, the scariest stories to me are always where ostensibly somebody is trying to protect their family or do the right thing, do a good thing, and they become the monster, they become the danger.
I'm talking with author Karen Russell. Her novel Swamplandia was set in a theme park in the Everglades, and she's just published a new collection of stories called Vampires in the Lemon Grove. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. You can hear Intersection three times a week, Tuesday morning at 9:30, Wednesday evening at 6:30, and Saturday morning at 7:30. You can also find previous episodes online at wmfe.org/intersection. Each week, Intersection posts a podcast available at our website. You can join the conversation online at our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, or email us at intersection@wmfe.org. Karen, I want to talk a little bit about Swamplandia now. You know, that book was such a success, and I'm wondering, when you said about thinking about publishing your next work, I mean, was that intimidating to follow up on a book like Swamplandia?
Oh, well, I think I was lucky because about half these stories I wrote during adulterous flings from Swamplandia, and then I'd been so excited. You know, I spent most of my 20s in that swamp, so I was so excited to kind of go to some different continents, just try out some different voices and time travel and things. So, but yeah, I was and remain, like, it wasn't that long ago, so I think I'm still kind of flabbergasted that that book found readers at all. I mean, there was a time when I wasn't even sure. There was a long time when I was like, who is going to publish this story about alligator wrestlers and a girl that dates the dead? Likely no one. So I think somehow, like, just the relief that it, those gator wrestlers ever made it out of my mind and onto the page overwhelms any kind of anxiety that I hope future work can, you know, just continue to grow in things.
I mean, you were talking before about this fascination in popular culture now with zombies and apocalyptic things like that. Yeah. Do you feel like your writing is just kind of come along at the right time because people are interested in that, so there's a good audience for it?
You know what we were saying about Stephen King, that it turns out there are millions of people who want to read about Cujo and Girls Lost in the Woods and you know, The Shining, sort of sane, ordinary people, that something about that must strike a chord with them. That's how I felt with Swamplandia, and it's so fun to come to Florida. I think, like, the nicest compliment I got was from someone who grew up on an actual alligator wrestling farm and really liked the book. And that seemed incredible, impossible, you know, but also that people, you know, people that I wouldn't expect to necessarily enjoy hanging with this weird adolescent girl on her underworld quests found something to like in the book. That remains kind of miraculous to me.
Swamplandia, for people who haven't read it, it's set in a dilapidated amusement park in the Everglades. And I'm wondering, how do you get that mixture of real and supernatural?
I really think, I've tried to come up with some other answers to this question, but I do think just South Florida itself I owe a great debt to. The whole state is kind of narrated. And if people talk about magical realism, where it's supernatural things narrated in a naturalistic register, that's like all of Florida. Like, really, everything is coming to you in this same kind of matter-of-fact tone. So you get something like in Orlando, there are all these sort of artificial worlds right next to one another, like, you know, Disney and Bible World and Gatorland are all shoulder to shoulder. And then there's sort of, you know, real people living their lives in suburbs, you know, right next door to, you know, like fireworks that go off. Like clockwork. So I guess I think that the blend of the kind of the real and the surreal is just my backyard.
Did you visit a lot of those older roadside attractions when you were growing up? I mean, you mentioned Gatorland.
No, we went to tons of, Florida is such a big state too that I think I didn't have a lot of references from saner states because it's just so long. And we started out of Miami, and so we'd go on these road trips. We never really made it much north of Tampa. Like, we would just get exhausted and, like, slowly sink back down the peninsula. So I also had this sort of nostalgia for places that I wasn't able to go because my parents were always talking about, you know, the Serpentarium or sort of these kind of mom-and-pop places that had vanished by the time I was born in the 80s. So we went to some, and then also I just kind of was bathed in, you know, the glory days talk of these older generations.
Do you think as a writer, though, I mean, are you more attracted to places which have got a slightly quirky edge to them rather than the bigger, more well-put-together theme parks?
Oh, yeah, always, always. I mean, I would always prefer, you know, like Parrot Jungle, where it's just a little, not ugly stepsister, you know, but it doesn't have kind of that corporate sheen. I think I wasn't so crazy about. Every kid loves Disney, right? It's sort of compulsory in Florida, and then your parents pay so much for those passes that that you know you feel obliged to love it. But I remember being a little put off by there's a kind of passivity that place encourages. It's like your dreams have been spoon-fed to you. They've already been milled by this corporate machine, and I think even kids sense that. So these weirder places that were truly eccentric, run by, you know, cross-eyed outlaws and overly familiar, you know, women in fake Indian dress or whatever. I kind of, those places I like just because they felt human and weird. Mm-hmm. And there was room to imagine if you're a kid.
And, you know, the other thing that comes out in the novel Swamplander is there's a pretty strong theme of grief running through it. And I'm wondering, why is that theme important? And is there any sense of autobiography in that?
Yeah, I think, I get wary about talking about my actual family because they're private people who have been cursed, you know, with my brother's a writer too, so that's just a terrible curse for a private family. But there's some emotional autobiography, I think, to some of the things that the Big Trees undergo. None of it's, you know, one-to-one. I mean, my mom is a beautiful woman who has never gone swimming with any kind of reptile, to my knowledge. Although she was in the FSU student circus. She and her brother, they were the Rolla Rolla Romanchuks.
Really?
Yeah, isn't that kind of amazing? There's all these amazing pictures of her and, like... black and white, and this student circus. And she said that the freaks would always have crushes on her, which was awkward because she was very kind.
What did she do in the circus?
She wasn't so gymnastic. I think her job was just not to put on a lot of weight and let my uncle, like, throw her around. He's sort of the gymnast. So she was sort of could have been – her job security was threatened by, you know, like lumber or, you know, balls to juggle. Like, she – it didn't was just sort of like a prop, I think, but that's not, you know, most of the story, I think my siblings are always saying, please tell people that we don't date the dead and that we're not, like, you know, fire crotch virgins who can't pronounce words. I mean, a lot of the very few of those details are one-to-one. I think the grief part, it's sort of multi-layered. Part of it, I think, is just kind of when I was coming of age, there was a huge kind of reckoning for the damage we'd caused to the environment. I think it was right. We were right on the cusp of this ecological awareness that some of the decisions that we'd made and South Florida's, the velocity of development there had actually destroyed, you know, this hydrological balance in a way that was irreparable, right? That the parts of the swamp we'd paved over were gone for good. So there, and you know, that once upon a time, you know, very recently, the sky would be dark with millions of birds. The coral reefs were vibrant. Like, there was this, it was sort of a real mourning, you know, a real sense of mourning and shock and kind of a sickness at the velocity of that change, like what we'd managed to ruin in one generation. So there's that mourning, I think, that's kind of more general. And then within the family, yeah, just I think in a lot of ways it's a story about how people can lose sight of one another when they're grieving. And how private that, even if you're doing it in parallel with a family, and even if you're all grieving the same loss, the journey that you're on is essentially a private one, you know, and it differs from family member to family member.
Was there some specific event that you were thinking back to when you were writing about that?
I think nothing more remarkable, right, than the losses that probably everybody alive who's lost someone has. I mean, I think fiction is such a consolation for me always because you realize that these places that you've been to, emotional places or psychic landscapes you think are, you know, your own. The voyages you've mapped yourself, you can see reflected in a book. And I always think, what an intimacy, you know, to see that another mind has been has been that way before.
Mm-hmm. Just thinking about the Everglades, and you talk about the sense of loss of the environment there. I mean, I get the feeling that, especially with a lot of Florida fiction, that sort of there's this sort of blend of environmentalism and adventure. And I think, you know, some of the kind of comedy crime writers like Carl Hyerson,
yeah,
and Dave Barry. I mean, why does that work so well?
Oh, gosh. Well, I love both of those guys. I owe them a great debt. You know, when I was like in sixth grade, I would read like Dave Barry Turns 40. And I was like, it's so true what he says about turning 40, you know. I sort of, and I thought both of them did such a good job of using humor to skewer using humor as a force for the good, you know, to point out some of the really absurd and dangerous things, you know, South Florida politics and things like that. There's something really immersive about South Florida's environment. I mean, the landscape here, if you can't walk outside without sort of encountering snakes and birds and palm trees and you know, it's just so densely foliated. So I think there's like this sense in Florida that the landscape is actually a character. It's a living, breathing, you're always interacting with it, right? And then adventure-wise, I don't think many people think of Florida as a frontier, but it is. It's sort of the southernmost part of the country. And I mean, as anybody who lives here knows, all kinds of lunacy is flowering at all times. We have like a year-round growing season for just lunacy. And those two, I think, have they're really deeply connected to the matter-of-fact weirdness of South Florida. And it's a good place to send a character kind of kayaking out into no man's land. There's a sort of whatever direction you go in Florida can become a twilight zone. So,
Now you're living in Philadelphia at the moment, correct?
Yeah, I'm in Philly right now.
Do you miss Florida?
Oh my gosh, I miss it so much. I wish I had more time down here. Philly's great too, but there is something really unique about whatever weird brew we've got down this way.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked before about sort of going from writing the novel Swamplandia to publishing a collection of stories, which really, you know, it's like a travelogue. It sort of jots around all over the globe. You've got Japan, Nebraska, Australia, the Antarctic. Do you like to visit the places you write about?
I think it was, I do, and I think Swamplandia was a joy to write because that really did feel like the landscape of my whole childhood, so I didn't have to look too far, you know? And then also we got to go on all these tax-deductible research trips to Gatorland and the Everglades and things. You know, I would take my family, I would force them to go camping on Watson's Island or whatever. But in this case, the collection was a little bit of a challenge because obviously I can't go to Meiji-era Japan, I mean, to my knowledge, right, unless there's that supernatural subway I haven't found yet. And that was fun in its own way, too. It was a different challenge to try to hop to places. The Antarctic, I just don't have the funds to get down there. It's an expensive trip. So it's fun to get to go for totally free in fiction.
So I want to ask you, too, Karen, what are you working on now?
I always wish that I had like a business plan to pitch at this moment, you know, like something nonfiction related where I just tell you about like a diet plan that I'm working on or some kind of amazing wrinkle cream I've invented. Right now I'm back to working on this second novel that I had been working on sort of off and on after Swamplandia. And it's set in kind of the landscape of Proving Up. It's and I haven't been there yet. I'm really hoping to get out there to visit. It's this farm in the Great Plains during the Dust Bowl drought, sort of fantastical historical.
Do you prefer writing short fiction or novel?
I think that they can both be excruciating in their own special ways. I had a lot of fun going back to stories because you can take so many risks and you can try on, you know, just do so much different kinds of ventriloquy. But it's fun to settle down into a novel. It's fun to put down stakes and really get to know your characters.
You're listening to Intersection. I've been talking to South Florida writer Karen Russell. She's the author of the novel Swamplandia and has a new book out, a collection of short stories, Vampires in the Lemon Grove. Karen, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.